So, Father, we just pray that as your Spirit rested upon and anointed Jesus, so your Spirit will anoint the interview that follows and anoint Marvin as he shares something of his heart for you and for this city with us. Amen. So let's recognize the privilege we have of hosting the leader of our city as we welcome Marvin up to the front to one of these sofas. I think one of the greatest adverts for you from the start is that Kirsten and Caleb and Levi and Eden are with you this morning. And Caleb, Levi and Eden have chosen not to go to the kids' work, but stay and listen to their dad. So I reckon that's a pretty good plug. I reckon we're in for a good time.
See the joy on Caleb's
face. Yeah. Yeah, it's just well the film isn't on your face, actually, Caleb, at the moment. There we go. Well, Marvin, it's great to have you with us. Thank you for making time out today and later at the 5 as well. For those who may not know, Marvin's been the mayor of Bristol since 2016. And at that point, he became the first directly elected black mayor in Europe. Married, as I've said, to Kirsten and three lovely children, and has been named one of the most influential black leaders in the UK. So, Marvin, welcome. And firstly, just tell us a little bit about your Bristol born and bred, unlike Maurice. Tell us a little bit about your childhood and your journey to faith. Put us in the picture of...
So, I'm always wary that I've told this story a few times, so I hope if anyone's heard it before. So, yeah, my mum had me 1972. And I say that because it is a birth of the time. White woman, unmarried, no money, brown baby on the way. Yeah, there's a lot that goes into that that then echoed out through my early years. So we lived in St. Paul's, first of all, City Road. My mum will tell those stories about what it was like to grow up in that Windrush time. Life was a bit tough. We ended up in a refuge for a little while, went down to Exmouth, came back, lived in Lawrence Weston, and then moved to Easton in 1978. And my mum still lives in the same house there now. And but through that time, I think my mum always had something. She grew up in South Wales in Cevin, just outside Merthyr Tydfil. There's very much chapel, you know, the legacy of the revival and all that. So there was always something in my childhood which was about God, and I think I always believed. But when we moved to Easton, I was about 8 years old, and an old friend from the 60s, 70s said to mum, "Well, you should come to church." And it was Trinity Tabernacle, Andy Padgett. And we went there, and they said, "You need Jesus in your life." And to me, as an eight-year-old, that just made sense. And so I did it. And then with varying degrees of commitment and you know, success on my part, that's been my path ever since, really.
I often think I didn't have much of a life before being a vicar, but you did have a life before becoming mayor of Bristol. So tell us a little bit about just a couple of things that you did before getting into this particular role.
So... Journey-wise, I went to St. George Schools, now City Academy. First dream I had to be a Royal Marines officer. I spent quite a few years running around in hills and all that, but got bad eyesight, so I wasn't able to complete things. And then I was at university, and I was looking for what to do. I just didn't know what to do outside of that. So I did a master's, and then I went to work for Tier Fund. I worked for Tier Fund for 3.5 years. From Tier Fund, and it's very much me searching, actually, what is Christian politics? Christian used to say, Tier Fund would say, is there Christian development? Is there a way that international development, Tier Fund works in a way that is different from, say, the Oxfams or Save the Children's? And I had that question about politics. And I read Jim Wallace's book, Soul of Politics, and I thought, oh, I really want to go and learn about Christian politics, Christian political activism. So I went to work in Washington for a year with Sojourners. And while I was there, I met Tony Campolo. And the way Tony works is, I said to Tony, he was teaching at Eastern University, this Christian university where I met Kirsten, actually. And I said, "Tony, I want to come to your university and do the master's in economic development." He said, "Just turn up, I'll pay for you." So so I went to Eastern, did another master's in economic development with Tony. Ron Sider was teaching there as well, Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger. And then came back to Bristol to work for Radio Bristol after that. Did 5 years, left the BBC, went to work in the voluntary sector, then went to work in public health team at the National Health Service. Went to Yale for 6 months on this leadership program, and then And then the kind of the ball started rolling around the mayoral election. We had a referendum in 12. I went for it, lost, you know, stayed in the city, went for it again and won it.
Fantastic. So it'd be good to begin to dig into what it's like to be an elected mayor leading a city. And let's start with, I mean, the complexity of modern political life. I've heard you say before that there's no such thing as totally clean decisions. And obviously you've been involved in some high-profile stuff, the Arena, Western Harbourside, Clean Air Act. Talk us a little bit through what you mean by there's no totally clean decisions and how, you know, the challenge to a mature form of politics.
So, actually, are there any West Wing fans in the room? There you go. These are good people. All right. There's a fantastic West Wing episode where they're talking about the relationship between the US and China. And there's a point where CJ Craig, this is totally an in-house conversation, said complexity is not a vice. And the President Bartlett says to someone, there are very few binary issues, right? And often when people approach issues as binary, they end up with a load of dead bodies hanging around, right? It's the same in politics. One of the challenges I've made to kind of like activism is I'm fine for you to take a position, but you've got to stand with the consequences of the decision you're hoping to be made. I think one of the biggest challenges to our political system is actually taking very simplistic binary framework and applying it to multidimensional issues. Right? You think about that in the church, right? There's a very simple question to the church. Why can't you all just get together? Right? It's more complicated than that, isn't it? Yeah? But, you know, it's one God. Why can't you all just be in one big building, overcome class differences, racial differences, gender differences, and just, it's more nuanced. Sometimes these differences are unforgivable in some sense. They're silly. And sometimes, actually, they're subtle but significant, right? Same with political decisions. So I'll give you an example. Clean air zones. We need clean. Bristol has dirty air, right? And we need to clean it up. So we got real pressure to take action on clean air, and we were doing it. But here's the rub, right? If you just implement a clean air zone, we know that it will disproportionately impact low-income people, impact access to the hospital, impact the costs in the hospital supply chain, and threaten small business. So just this week, I've had the Road Hauliers Association in telling me that because now the only way you're going to be able to come into a zone without being charged is by having a Euro 6 diesel HGV. The market for Euro 5 diesel HGVs has just dropped. So the companies that would need to sell their Euro 5 to transition to Euro 6 is now less able to do so. So you end up with these unintended consequences of things you do. And the danger is that small, medium-sized haulage companies cannot afford the transition. So you'll end up with the big companies covering the cost of the transition and us losing small companies. And it's these kind of unintended consequences that often are missed in the headlines and the tweets and the banners, but actually that we have to grapple with. And that goes for decisions about the Arena, Western Harbour, some of these things that are really held up as controversial. There's many, many angles to them that are often not shared in the public domain. And that's a real challenge.
I remember, Marvin, when you were campaigning originally and when you came into office, you talked, as many politicians do, about a different kind of politics. And I'm aware that you opened up City Hall in a different way, the City Office, trying to get cross-party, bringing different heads of different aspects of the life of the city together. Can you just talk us a little bit through why you did that, how it's worked, the fruit that you've seen?
So it very much comes from working in public health. So I worked on a program called Race Equality in Public Health, right? Race Equality in Mental Health. And the harsh reality is that, you know, there is horrific race and class differences in levels of mental ill health, both in the incidence but also in the treatment too. But the determinants of those inequalities are not just within the National Health Service. The National Health Service, in and of itself, cannot determine levels of mental health. It's down to housing policy, educational attainment, poverty, you know, what we talked about, food poverty, right? So as a city, what I'm very aware of is that what people get from Bristol is not the result of decisions made in City Hall alone. that people sit at the intersection of decisions made across the whole range of organizations. The health service, big employers, the criminal justice system, faith organizations, voluntary sector. So I organized a meeting when I was first elected and brought in chief execs and directors from right across Bristol. Now, in that room, we had about £6 billion worth of financial footprint presented. And in that room, the people together, including universities, employed 70,000 people. So I said to them, if we decided to do one thing, if we all agreed, what could we not do? And that's the kind of, that's our understanding of leadership that we've brought to the city. That if we're serious about city leadership, it cannot just be a disproportionate focus on whatever does or does not manage to get out of City Hall. It's about organizing the, it's all about organizing the city. And that's not command and control, it's convene and ask and influence. And so we've really, really tried to, you know, take that seriously through the One City approach. The other piece is that, for me, is leadership is not all having all the answers and everything I can do. I've said to a number of people that, you know, my job in many ways is to find good people who want to do good things and then help them get those things done. Andy Street is a classic example. Andy Street came and responded to a challenge we put out to the city, which is, don't just come to me and make me an ask. Come and make me an offer, and then tell me what you need from me to deliver that offer. So Andy Street came and said to the city, at these things we call city gatherings now, he said, my offer is, I can end child hunger in Bristol. That's my offer. My ask is, this is what I need from you as a city to enable me to do it. I need access to children's centres, access to schools, I need political support, I need venues and that. So we know what the deal is then. So all my job is to say, right, let's get you access to children's centres, schools and so forth. Same with Jeremy Sweetland and housing. If any of you know Jez Sweetland, the Bristol Housing Festival. Jez wants to get it done. We've just backed Jez. And Jez has gone off like a piece of dynamite now. I tell you what, I sit on the Archbishop's, Archbishop of Canterbury's Housing Commission now. When I don't go, Jez goes to Lambeth Palace and sits on that. What an amazing kind of release of talent. And Bristol is now known as the leading city on modern methods of construction for housing. And that's Jez Sweetland. Yeah? And that's a Bristol, that's just finding a good person and backing that good person. And that's what we've tried to do.
It's fantastic. I mean, I can testify myself, and many, many people can, about the way that, as I said earlier, Marvin, you've opened doors, particularly to people of faith, not exclusively.
Obviously. Be careful with statements like that. There's a
okay.
No, I'm joking, boy. There's a little bit of a thing about me being a person of faith on Twitter. You gave me the dog collar, didn't
did.
You, last time?
A few years
my
ago,
my Twitter hashtag was Vicar Reese.
I presented Marvin with a dog collar, just said Rev Reese on it, because that was a rather unkind nickname in some of us, some of the political opponents. But just thinking about that opening doors, I mean, I'm now having a conversation with other Christian leaders and some other, particularly Muslim and Sikh and Hindu leaders, with Anne James, who's the Director of Children and Family Services in the city. And I think Andy Street will often say that 10 years ago, the church would not have been welcomed into the table at any of these things. And so I guess, question, how have you done that? How's that worked? And I know there's been a personal cost to you. So just talk about that, how you manage that balance between personal faith, and obviously, as we've heard from the reading, our faith in Jesus believes that we're called to make a difference in the world. We'll come on to the City of Hope in a moment. But how have you managed that?
It's funny, actually. So I've just come back from Local Government Association Labour Leaders event. I was talking to the leader of Bradford. And I didn't know until then, but she actually said, oh, I'm a Christian. And she said, you're open with your faith. And I said, well, it's a funny thing, because I haven't gone out to be open. I've just been what I am, yeah? And, you know, I often use biblical proverbs in my talks, you know? People don't know they're from the Bible, but they, you know, faith, suffering, perseverance, character, hope. This is a big one for me in Bristol as well. I think it's been quite easy in many ways, because, as I said, if your approach is to find good people who want to get good stuff done and have the ability to do it, if you back them, these are the people turning up. It's Andy Street, it's Rachel Milano, you know, it's Rob Scott Cook coming along, you know, Ed Robery. What there was a discussion in my office, because we did begin to get some heat, yeah? It was all Twitter and all that kind of nonsense about look, Marvin's trying to introduce a theocracy. He's hanging out with these mad right-wing evangelicals from the United States. Tony Campolo, who's not... I thought, you probably want to read his stuff, you know? So there was a real effort to chuck some mud around. And my chief of staff, Kevin Slocum, we were in the office and they were saying, we need to kind of not talk about this so much. This was what some of my guys were saying. Kevin said, look, the church is turning up with passion, expertise, and they deliver, right? They're delivering food, they're delivering housing. What are you going to do, turn them away? So that's been my point. You know, people are turning up, wanting to get real stuff done. They're not mucking around. They're not playing games. We hold together in the church that desire to be ambitious for a place and have the big story, but we hold it together with facing the reality that 25% of our kids are in poverty. You know, that's the kind of maturity of understanding of place that we need. And so it's easy to open a door to that. When I ran the race equality program for the mental health service, I said to my team, you could just turn up at the commissioners and the NHS Bristol, as it was then, and just berate them for being racist and overseeing racist institutions. I said, that's not the approach. The approach is to be the solution. So they ended up knocking on our door. And I've said this to a lot of... what's happened is, I think, that people like that have actually been solutions, right? When we've wanted to reach out for foster families, we found in the church a solution. That makes it easy for the exec directors and our directors to want to reach out to people like Andy. And that's the credibility. And that's, I challenge anyone who wants to challenge me for engaging with faith organizations, will you step up and offer the level of solution that we're being offered by a faith community? Then you're welcome through the door. But if all you want to do is come and moan and make snide comments on Twitter, I haven't got time to expend my emotional energy on that. My emotional energy has to be directed towards people who are turning up with a determination to make the city better. That's where I'm going to invest.
Good. Yay. I think Eden thinks it's the end because we've applauded.
She's walking.
One of the, I think many people, many commentators acknowledge that one of the curses in political life is its short-termism. We have this constantly recycled parties, individuals, faces, what have you. You've worked to launch a city plan that goes through to what, 2050? Can you just talk us a little bit about that, and maybe we can then talk a bit about City of Hope, but let's, the city plan, how's that come about? What's the aim? For people who may not have ever heard of the city plan, tell us why.
I will talk about that, but can I just start with just a bit of a challenge as well? I think that quite often, and this is not just since I got elected, I had an amazing opportunity to go to Yale University a few years ago, and we went out for breakfast with Stanley McChrystal, General McChrystal. I'm not name dropping here, but you know, he's in charge of Afghan forces for Obama. And he said the price of getting involved in public life is now so high that good people just won't do it. It was a really interesting kind of insight. I thought I was going to meet this meathead special forces general, but a very, very, very clever and thoughtful person. And actually, that short-termism, we say we don't want short-term politics, and yet the whole framework for assessing political performance is short-term. Just like we want people with a long-term, and yet the whole framework for assessing the performance of companies is based on a quarterly return and your dividend and so forth. So we build that short-termism in. And I shared recently a quote from Clive Woodward. If you haven't read it, it's a brilliant book called Winning. And he says, success does not happen in a straight line, right? And they nearly sacked Clive Woodward, really quick, short into his time as England coach, won the World Cup. And he didn't get off to a good start, and they nearly sacked him. And it's that kind of drive to have daily success, to avoid the daily negative headline, that actually drives short-termism into politics. So it is something that politicians serve up, but they do it in partnership with the press and with the public, right? We're all part of that drive. So the aim of, I think when I came in, I said one of the best things we could offer Bristol was a long-term plan that transcends the electoral cycle. And so we've worked with Bristol, we've worked with the city to write the One City plan. If you can, this is online. And, that proverb, without a vision, the people perish, right? And I'm drawing on these little things. And there's Arnie Graf, who's this organizer from the US, community organizer, trained Obama. He said, you know, that quote, power abhors a vacuum. If you leave a space, something will fill it. So our question was, where does Bristol intend to be in 2050? Now, that seems like a long way away, but any of you that are over the age of 32 in the room knows it comes very quickly, actually 30 now. That will come very quickly, right? So where do we want to be in 2050? Well, no one had that statement, right? So we got to say where we want to be in 2050. And if we want to be there in 2050, where do we need to be in 2038? 2034, 2029, 20. So that was the challenge we set the city to do. And we did it at the city gathering with all those city leaders. We did a piece of work, actually, which was there were like 500 strategies in Bristol live at the moment across us, police, health service, business, and so forth. 500 strategies. You know what? Very few of them went beyond 2022. We did this analysis in 2017. So as a city of nearly 500,000 people, we had plans that went to 2022. And of those plans, they weren't even talking to each other. So talk about chaos. So our point was, how do we begin to bring some order to the mass of energy? And how do we begin to speak into that void that sat beyond 2022? Because if we didn't, we just get the future that was given up to us by national government policy, international trends, whatever may happen. So that's what we've tried to do. We've got a clear statement of what we want to be in 2050, and then we've got a timeline of outcomes and campaigns and actions that we need to deliver every year up to 2050. Now, we say a few things about that plan. It's not perfect. It's not complete. We refresh it every year, but it is there, right? And a friend of mine from Hope Chapel, Martin Sturgeon, he's a colonel in the army. I'm not going to use it. He says, make a plan. Any plan, just make a BLOODY plan. And that's the point for the city. Just, you've got to have something, and then you've got something to grapple with. But it's really important to point out, it is not written by the council. What we've done is facilitated it. It is a reflection of the views and aspirations and hopes of the whole range of organizations and community organizations in Bristol. And I hope that gives it authority. That means that it transcends the next election. If I was to lose in May, there's a whole bunch of organizations that have written that plan together and will expect the city to continue working in that way. Right.
We hear a great deal in our world today about the threat to democracy, the threat to political life. What are your own views on that? What do you see as the biggest threat to political life and democracy, say, here in the UK?
I think there are numerous threats. I mean, one is I've, since getting elected, I remember giving a talk on College Green once, and just before I went on stage, I remember thinking to myself that actually, I think we fall into quite a lazy comfort, believing that our democracy, our political culture, our society is fundamentally coherent and strong, and gets challenged every now and again by circumstance. And I've begun wondering if actually it's the other way around, that fundamentally we're moving towards disintegration and chaos and division. But actually, the only thing that keeps it online is people constantly pushing to defend it. And I would actually suggest that Martin Luther King would probably say the same thing if he read his letter from Birmingham jail. He says, you know, people have reached a lazy assumption but you combine time in what we call education and we're fundamentally moving towards progress. And he says, people of ill will have been much more effective and more organized than people of goodwill. But I actually think of all the challenges, I actually begun to believe that the poor quality of our civic discourse now is one of the biggest threats we have for a number of reasons. One is it really distances people from real politics. Like I said before about nuance and complexity. The inability, I get it all the time. Obviously, I get it all the time. I'm not pleading victimhood or poverty, but one is, as I said, the Stanley McChrystal point. People who don't want to deal with that just will not get involved in public life. And I think I've talked to people who I think would be fantastic to have in public leadership. And they just say, it's not for me, Marv. I can't get involved. I don't know how you do it. And I've looked at that person. I just thought, we've lost a fantastic talent and ability and bunch of integrity there because it doesn't want to step into that public space. The second thing I think is that it just distances people from real political discussion. And then you end up with this ping pong binary, and then you end up, I must say, I mean, you end up with the kind of politics we've seen over the last few years, I think, which is, you disagree with me, so I'm going to treat you as evil. Barack Obama, in his book, Audacity of Hope, which I really recommend reading, he says that one of the problems with the way the political system works now is it would take you 10 seconds to represent my argument and portray me as evil. It would take me 20 minutes to explain that argument to you in all its nuance. But we're now in a 10-second culture. You know, we don't do 20 minutes. And that's a real, real challenge to us. And it undermines our politics. It undermines the kind of people that go into politics. And it undermines the ability of people in politics to talk about what they do in a real way. So, I mean, I'll talk to anyone after. The decision on the arena, right? On Temple Island. In my office, they're saying to me, Marv, just build the arena on Temple Island, right? Just build it. No one's going to understand the nuance, right? And if you don't build the arena on Temple Island, it could lose you the election. But what you won't know is all the financial reports said it's £160 million plus of debt for the city. The margin of return, the risk, like one financial fault is minimal. We'd be vulnerable to a private sector company coming to us and renegotiating the rent it would pay for the arena and taking that rent below the amount of repayments we'd be making on that debt. We anticipate about 1,500 cars driving into the middle of the city for every arena gig. And you've then got an arena next to a train station, and it's a security threat. You know, someone phones up, threatens to bomb the arena, you close down the train station. All these other little things floating around that just would not in a public, public domain. So these are some of the real challenges, you know. And I'm not trying to resurrect and justify myself on the arena decision, but it just says that there's so much more to some of the decisions than are often in the public domain.
So how do you personally, as a believer, as a human being, cope with some of the really quite, the criticism of you goes beyond policy, goes beyond political party, it goes right to personality, and that can't be easy. How do you deal with the criticism that you get as a leader?
So I say to my children, right, and we actually had this discussion on the car on the way here, if someone says something about you in school and you just know it's not true, why would you get upset about it? Right, you just spin your wheels. So I actually spend quite a bit of time reflecting on that advice I give to my children on that sense. I think the other is, I grew up, life wasn't easy, right? And there were times when I come under serious threat, right? So I once spoke out of turn and I offended a gang, like a local gang. And then word went round they were going to come and get me. I was like, kind of like 14. I was like, oh gosh, you know, that was a serious incident, right? On another occasion, a guy said he was going to come and stab me, and he wasn't. I knew he wasn't, but he was talking. And I said to someone, I went through all that as a teenager. Do you think, really, that sitting in City Hall or facing anonymous people on Twitter saying mean things about me is a bother? It's not, right? Let's get it into perspective. There are many worse things going on the planet, and I've seen them, and whether it be through secondhand, through tier funds, seeing people overseas, or what I went through myself, my life and the life of my friends. So I get it into perspective. Having said that, I do find it frustrating. Part of that is because I'm a human being, so I'm frustrated about it on a personal level. Of course I am. But I'm also irritated about it because, actually, the challenges the city faces are real and serious. It's hungry children, right? It's the woman, actually, you'll know about that, that couldn't feed her kids for the weekend because she had £2.50 and no food in the fridge, right? It's people losing their homes. It's women fleeing domestic violence. It's the kids we got in the care system. These are real. And to consume the public space with what Jon Snow called political flatulence, it's just unforgivable to me. If you want to do political debate, do real political debate about real issues, rather than nonsense. And I would really encourage people to read Jon Snow's speech he gave after Grenfell, when he talked about that, And that's the thing that really annoys me. There's a bandwidth that we have for engaging in the real issues of our time. And there are people consuming that bandwidth with nonsense. And I don't have much patience for that, to be perfectly frank.
Okay. Just time for two more. I want to get to City of Hope. That's a phrase that just seems to have come alive in the city. Businesses, charities, different sectors have really got behind it. It's a word that appeals to people across the spectrum. I just want to give you an opportunity, as we draw towards a close, what's your personal vision for what a city can be? If you were to revisit the city in 2050, what do you want to see? What does it mean for you to be living in a city of hope?
That's a big one. I think, ultimately, the circumstances of your birth don't determine your life chances. Because that, to me, is the definition of hope. It's worth knowing, I have told this story here before, but I've always been fascinated by the idea of hope. So when I was at BBC, I pitched a documentary on hope. And my original idea was, everyone uses the word, but what does it mean? It's everything and nothing, right? We just throw it out there. Oh, I hope Liverpool win tomorrow. Or I hope this and that, you know. But it's profound. If you don't have hope, how do you get up in the morning? And I wanted to know what people's sources of hope were, you know. So theologically, Christians, Muslims, Sikhs, you know, atheists. What do they mean by hope? Anyway, BBC said it was too abstract. They didn't accept it as a pitch. But anyway, I'm always been fascinated. And in 2012, I wanted to talk about hope, but I thought the easy kick on me was, oh, look, he's trying to be like Barack Obama. Da, da, da. So I avoided it. But I still, I meet Rob Scott Cook was meeting him once a month. And Rob said to me, Marvin, I think we should be talking about Bristol as a city of hope. And I said, Rob, I'm a bit wary of that, all right? It's an easy hit on me. But then I was meeting some church leaders and just really zoomed in on that passage, right? We don't despise our sufferings because suffering produces perseverance, character, character, hope. And that means a lot to me because I like hope because not optimism to me makes a commitment to looking at things positively. And I find that a little bit superficial. Hope grapples with suffering, the reality of it, the reality of injustice, the need to overcome. And if I can do, was it Evan Almighty where what's his name, Morgan Freeman says, if you ask God for love, does he just give you love or the opportunity to love? If you ask for resilience, does he just give you resilience or the opportunity to be resilient? So to me, there's something about that journey within that. So we started talking about Bristol as a city of hope. And for whether you are destitute on the streets of Bristol or living in Sneed Park, wondering how you're going to get through life, everyone needs hope. How can we make this a city in which you can face the end of the day thinking tomorrow we can be better than today? And it just seems to have landed. And it's now in the city, Bristol City Council's corporate strategy. It says, we want to make Bristol a city of hope. In the One City plan, it says, we want to make Bristol a city of hope. And on the city wall, you can go and have a look at it in the foyer. Rob got together with Mohammed El Sharif, with the Bristol Muslims and faith groups, and presented a plaque to the city that says, Bristol, City of Hope. And it is now up on the wall in City Hall, next to the plaque that says, Bristol, City of Sanctuary. And to me, that's actually quite profound. What do we say? Words are significant. Ben Okri, the Nigerian author, said, if you want to destroy a people, poison the stories they tell about themselves, right? Which to me speaks into Twitter and our journalism. Poison the stories they tell about themselves. It's not about being doughy-eyed and saying everything's great, but it is about saying, but the first step on becoming a city of hope is about saying we want to be a city of hope. And then we work out all the things we need to get there. Delivering good quality homes, making sure children aren't hungry, investing in mental health, tackling transport poverty, and all the other things. But we have to make that statement that that's what we want to be. That's the first step.
Fantastic. And finally, last couple of minutes. Irrespective of of you and your office, anybody out there who is thinking, City of Hope, what can I do to play my part in making Bristol a city of hope? What two or three things would you say to us, maybe as a collective community, but certainly to us as individuals?
So I'm always appealing for people to step onto the field of play, all right? And I would encourage people to think about getting elected. And I'm not recruiting to any party. My first point is get elected, party second, right? We just need good people doing debate from all political persuasions. And I recently recruited to the magistracy. I filled City Hall with about 70 black and Asian people, me and Asher. And 11 of the 33 magistrates appointed last year were from black and Asian communities. That has never, ever happened before, right? But there's always a line I get from people. They say, well, that's not for me. My point is, well, maybe it's not about you, right? Moses didn't think it was for him, right? Gideon didn't think it was for him, right? It's not about you. It's about the skills you have and putting them at the disposal of a city that's desperately in need of people with integrity in positions of leadership. And I think that boundary between elected office and everyday life needs to be much more porous. If you get elected, you don't have to sit there for 16 years, 20 years. You could do 4 years. Go in, blitz the care system, blitz housing, you know, blitz transport, and then move on and do something else. So think about getting elected. But remember, it's not just about political elections. There's the magistracy, there's school governors, there's boards of our voluntary sector organisations that desperately need expertise to make sure they're financially viable. The other thing I would suggest is look at the One City Plan, at the kinds of things that are listed out, and you could begin to say, right, I want to be involved in that, and then you can reach out. So there's priorities in there like domestic violence and abuse. You want to get involved in that? There are people doing it with the public health team. You might want to get involved in our commitment to double the tree canopy in Bristol by 2045. You know, we've got to start that now, obviously. So again, you can step and get involved. So please think about your own city leadership positions, but look at the One City Plan, at what we want to get done, get in touch, and we'll put you in touch with the people that are leading on those priorities that are set out.
Fantastic. Why don't we firstly give Marvin a round of applause for being so open with us. Thank you so much. And using the power of my office, I'm going to divert 25% of that applause to Caleb and Levi and Eden, who've just been so brilliant here at the front. A couple of things. We're going to pray for Marvin and for Kirsten and the family in a moment as a church family. And then I'm going to ask Marvin to pray for us. And then Neil and Joe will lead us back into some sung worship as we draw the gathering to a close. But just two more things. One is to remind you that of that influence event at Woody's on the final Saturday of February, where Marvin is one of the speakers there. And then also just to say that as we, I'm one of a number of Christian leaders who've been working with leaders of the other faith communities in Bristol. And we've been working for about a year on a faith manifesto. And that faith manifesto is going to be published in early March. And we have agreed 5 common aspirations, which we certainly agree are common to all the major faiths in Bristol. And we think are probably common aspirations to most of humanity. And so that will be launched on the 2nd of March down at City Hall. And then we're also pitching as faith communities, so not just Christian, but across the faith communities, to take one of the official hustings. We've booked the cathedral down on College Green for the 25th of March. David Garmston, anchor of BBC Points West, has agreed to host that. And all the candidates standing for election as mayor will be invited to that. So there's a few more dates for your diary. 29th of Feb, 2nd of March for the launch of the Faith Manifesto, 25th of March, if we get permission from Bristol City Council electoral team, we'll be holding a hustings organised by the faith communities of Bristol. Okay,